Get ready to expand your horizons and discover great reads. This is Bookbound, a library podcast.
Welcome back to Bookbound. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined at the mic by Cheryl Lindemann and Maricela Garza. It's December. Yeah. It is the end of the year. We have almost spent our budgets, if not totally overspent our budget. No. we have spending down, trying to get as much stuff into the library before the new year. Yep. And it's been a year. I don't know where it all went.
Yeah.
We've got a wide range of things to talk about today, but one of the things is we've got our Cattle Best, our staff voted.
Yes, we did. Yes. We did. This title, The Teacher of Nomad Land, by Danielle Nayeri, is on the list.
Yeah.
And I love this book. Oh, my goodness. This is a story about kind of a tween boy who's determined to stick with his sister. The setting is World War II in Iran. The British and the Russian troops have occupied that territory, so they kind of have to leave. But they're orphans. Their father has recently been killed. And his name is Babak, and the sister's name is Sana. She's 8 years old, and she's totally not just adorable, but just wise and smart and funny. But, you know, initially they get separated because, you know, what often happens with orphans or children without parents is that they get separated because they can't all go to the same home. But they're with family or relatives, really, and, the relatives are not exactly welcoming. So they, you know, come up with a plan to escape. And they have decided that they're going to go into a mountainous region. It's called the Zagros Mountains, which is not exactly near Turkey and Iraq, but sort of. Anyway, they are heading into this region because their father was a teacher, and he used to teach the nomadic children of that area. These are families that move a lot, the nomadic people. They speak a language called, I think it's Bakhtiari? Bakhtiari. And they're people who don't necessarily have literacy as part of their culture. And that was one of the things I really liked about the book is that both Babak and Sana, they're so interested in education and in literacy. And Daniel Nayeri, I'll say he's probably really interested in teaching us, or the readers, a little bit about the Persian Arabic alphabet and just how interesting it is. Because throughout the book, there are little sprinkles of the how you would say words in that script. So, but they are off on this region. They are, you know, trying to kind of earn their keep, but at least in the beginning, it doesn't necessarily go as they expect. So they get kind of, not necessarily thrown out, but kind of sent away, or you're on your own, kids. And they are looking for food. That was another thing about the book that really stood out to me, is like there are all these things growing kind of on the side of the mountain. They're making acorn bread. They're eating something called zalzalak, which is actually a hawthorn fruit. It's a type of a berry that's found in Iran. And it's just a really cool story of children during this time period making their way. They run into a baddie, a German spy who's looking for a Polish Jewish boy. And it's very sobering, I guess, to think this is happening in this part of the world. Not necessarily based in a true story, but a true period in history. So it's an intermediate reader, I would say, for fifth or sixth graders. It also won the National Book Award this year for youth. And
just slip that in there.
That's a really big deal, at least to me. I follow that award quite a bit. Daniel Nayeri is just a really amazing storyteller. And he's won other awards for children's book. I also want to recommend Everything Sad is Untrue, which is kind of his memoir. And he is an Iranian-born author. So, yeah, I really recommend that one.
I feel like we don't get enough of those stories.
No, we don't.
No, and it's funny because I'm kind of like this person, like, oh, I've read so many World War II stories, both from the children's fiction perspective as well as adults. But this was something like, oh, I don't think I knew this before, that the British and the Russians were in Iran during that time period to control kind of oil access and things like that. So.
We spent a lot of time getting that list pretty that we voted on, and so it is interesting. We both came up with titles we wanted to talk about this month that were on the best of list for that were picked by our cattle staff. So the book that I wanted to talk about first is actually one I read very early on and kind of went back and forth on how to present it, even. But it also won the National Book Award for nonfiction. And that's One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This by Omar El-Akkad. This is a book that kind of started in a tweet in October of 2023 that El-Akkad posted, "One day when it's safe, when there's no personal downside to calling a thing what it is, when it's too late to hold anyone accountable, everyone will have always been against this." It's about colonialism. It's about human rights. And at the heart, the book is, it's about that dream that I think we have had, but also anybody coming to not just the United States, but the West, and the quote-unquote West in general, is that you're coming to this place that has a promise of liberty and justice for all that does not live up to that promise in so many ways. And it's sobering. It's a really thought-provoking book. He is looking at it as his family immigrated from Egypt to both the U.S. and Canada. And it's looking at how we use our politics, our money, in ways that hurt people and don't make it easy for our own citizens or citizens of the world. So it's a very interesting, thought-provoking book, and I think people should give it a read.
Yeah, it's on all the end of year best of lists, and definitely one I'm going
to kind of
to
living up to the title to in read. A sense.
Yes, right.
That's one it's sobering, and like Maddie's, it's sobering, but it's a very interesting read, and it's a thought-provoking read, and it's looking at it from an angle that we probably don't look at it from enough. And he's looking at what's happening in our society here in the United States and seeing how it's not working for us, too.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, we're doing that. You can find the best of lists. They're in our library catalog right when this podcast comes out. You will be able to find them there, and we will be putting them out in different ways, so you'll be able to check out all those lists, titles for adults and teens and children. So runs the breadth.
10, 20, 30, 40 titles.
Yeah, 40 titles. So it's always kind of a fun process.
To see how it all works out.
To see how it all shakes out. So it kind of at that end of year reckoning, it's kind of hard to believe that we're here in some ways. And I know that we talk about this a lot, but I have a commitment to reading 2025 books in 2025. And I sort of make a cutoff for myself at the very end of the year to read other books. So right at the end, it was that push of what am I going to get in? You know, what are all these great offerings? And you look at the end of your list. I know I do. And I say, oh, I wish I could have read that. But we just... We have lives and other things to do. And it's like we can't constantly be reading. But one I did get in, and it was kind of fortuitous because I had maybe, 15, 20 things I could have picked as my last books to think about for this year that were 2025, right? And I was an airport bookstore, of all things, in D.C. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll pick this one up. It's one of the possibilities. So I bought it there, and I'm really happy I did. It's called Dead and Alive, Essays by Zadie Smith. And I remember when Zadie Smith came onto the scene, I was a very new librarian with white teeth in 2000. I have recently just picked up that book. I have never read it, and I will bring it hopefully to the podcast next year. But it was hot. And I remember circles and libraries, it was like, what is White Teeth? You know, what is this
PBS
book? Yeah, right?
Version of it.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there's, you know, so it's just somebody who I've always been fascinated by. I love essays. I feel like I didn't read enough of them this year, so this just hit the spot for me so well. I also have to say Zadie Smith is very solidly Gen X, and there was a bent of that to the essays. Something that I kind of felt like having, this is going to sound weird, but like a conversation. Maybe that's what a really good essay does. It provokes, it might, you know, hit you with ideas that you don't agree with, but it gets you thinking and you're kind of having this sort of conversation, maybe is the way she wrote, but it's really, really, really good. There's a huge range of essays in here. I think cantankerous is maybe too strong of a word, but she's very strongly like, this is how I feel, here's what it is, you know. And it starts out with a bang. I loved the first essay. I was so hooked. It is about artists' muses, and in particular focuses on an artist named Celia Paul, who was a British artist who was the muse of Lucian Freud, who was about 50-some when they met. And it kind of really examines how okay in some ways we have been as a culture with artist muses because the artist is so good and it's just kind of the way it is. And she really examines that and turns it over and pulls it apart, and it is an amazing essay. And also talks about Celia Paul's work as an artist herself and really examines that. But there's art, there's culture, there's a bit of a love letter to New York and to London, Willesden, London, where she grew up and now lives. There are essays about the algorithm, about tech, about politics. One of my other favorite essays was a kind of a movie criticism analysis of the movie Tar. And, you know, there's a lot of feminist analysis and things, but there's also this generational thread through the story or through the essay. And she's talking about reactions to Tar from different generations. And it has a really fun kind of Gen X twist at the end. So just a really interesting, thought-provoking group of essays. So,
okay. While we're on the topic of essays, I had been kind of watching this one come as it was coming. I will preface this by saying, while I do run the speculative fiction book discussion group for Cattle, which does read a whole range of fantasy, science fiction, and horror, I would not describe myself as a horror reader. I love a good ghost story. I like Twilight Zone. I like quirky and surreal and that sort of thing, but not necessarily macabre horror. But I picked up a book of essays called Why I Love Horror, edited by a kind of superstar Reader's Advisory librarian, Becky Siegel Spratford. And I was really surprised how much I loved this collection of essays. It is essays. Becky went to, she's a nationally recognized Reader's Advisory librarian, but she passionately champions the horror genre. And as friends among the authors, she approached a diverse group of kind of who's who of the, like, the newest generation of horror writers and said, give me an essay, tell me why you love horror. She went to Michigan's own Josh Mellerman. She went to who did The Bird Box. He takes a very philosophical approach, really like a classic philosophical discussion. Two guys on a train, one kind of looks at the other, what the other's reading, and says, I thought you would be reading something more, you know, intellectual or something. And it just sort of is a conversation between the two of them on a train. It has Paul Tremblay, who is the author of Cabin in the End of the World, Grady Hendrix.
And Another.
At what?
Another.
Say.
Another.
A book?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So yes, Cabin at the End of the World is probably his biggest book. Grady Hendrix, his essay was disturbing. Tananarive Due, who wrote The Reformatory, has a really interesting article, or essay. Stephen Graham Jones, who wrote Buffalo Hunter Hunter and Last Good Indian. It's just, each of them is a little different. Some of them feel a little bit more confessional. Some of them are, you know, really kind of point out how you can create these wild situations just sort of to balance out the wild situations that are happening in the world. It's just an interesting set of essays, and I was really surprised. I listened to it as an audiobook. really great presentation. So I just really suggest it.
Yeah. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's whether you're a reader or not, it actually is really interesting to understand kind of where both readers and writers are coming from who write in a genre maybe you don't understand or don't, you know, feel drawn to.
Yeah.
They're really compelling. And the other thing about Becky is that she set this up, and I do know Becky personally. She set this up so that with each article, with each essay, there's a brief introduction by her. It gives you a place to start. She gives a book to start with for that author. And then she also gives a read-alike author. So if you're looking to get started in horror,
nice.
This is actually a really, really nice collection.
Very cool.
You get a whole lot of titles. And then some of the authors are talking about their favorite authors in there as well, in their essays. So it makes for a very interesting reader's advisory tool, because that's what she does in life.
Yeah.
So,
very cool.
So librarians, check this out as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, I do not read a lot of horror myself, but occasionally I've been trying to dip my toes in there. What I have next is a graphic novel, a young adult graphic novel or teen graphic novel called Hunger's Bite by Taylor Robin. I'm not really sure I would consider it horror, but it's kind of described that way.
Okay.
This is about 1910-ish, sort of like, think back to the time of the Titanic, where there are luxury liners. And I got to say that the reason that I was even interested in this is because I recently took a trip to the UP, and I went by way of, I think it's called the U.S. Badger. Out of Ludington. And, you know, that ship is really old, or boat ship, really old, and very nostalgic. So I kind of, the ocean liner that's described in this book kind of reminded me of the ship. But anyway, Lark, SS Lark, as the ocean liner is called in the book, has a new owner. And who is it? It's a Mr. Honeycutt, who's rich beyond rich, dripping with money and demands and serve me attitude, and you must work harder, all this sort of thing. And we've got two youngsters, Nita and Emery, and Emery happens to be the captain's son. They've both grown up on this ship. And you can tell that Emery kind of has a little crush on Nita, or maybe, you know, has high hopes for her. They have grown up together because Nita and her brother are wards of the captain, Boatwright, or Emery's father. So they have, you know, these ideas of living on the ship, and Emery is happy with that, but Nita is not. She's dreaming of developing her own life. So where the horror comes in is there is a Mr. Wick Farley, who's kind of part vampire, part investigator.
Yikes.
He's been charged with coming onto the boat, and he has some pretty inhuman desires, I guess you could say, with his teeth. he ends up working with Nita to, you know, kind of keep Mr. Honeycutt from, like, totally taking over. And underlying it, I think, are, you know, really a lot of themes of kind of forcing the working class to do more than they can or than, you know, they should,
right. Really.
I mean, I've been on cruises before, and, you know, I would never want to make this kind of comparison, but I think that's, you know, to be constantly serving is hard. And the way it's depicted in this book, like, there's just, like, you can never take a break, according to Mr. Honeycutt, and just like, man. So this was just a really interesting book. There's curious use of color. There's a yellow umbrella that Investigator Vampire Man uses occasionally. It's just a really neat palette, I guess you could say, different sorts of colors. So I enjoyed it, and hope you'll pick it up.
So Investigator Vampire Man is not, in quotes, a bad guy then.
Well,
he might not be a good guy.
Yeah.
How about that?
Good guy,
okay. I don't want to give. We don't want to spoil
it. Nita thinks it's okay to work with him. At least to collaborate.
It's a complicated character, perhaps.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to move on to the next title. Another end of year must read for me. I'm not only going to talk about this title, but I'm going to recommend some of the author's other books. So the book is Bread of Angels by Patti Smith, a memoir. And I would like to put a plug out for several of her other books, including Just Kids, the memoir, and M Train, the memoir. And they're both, you can get audio versions where she reads them. I believe M Train was an award-winning audio that year. I would highly recommend that there's sort of a spoken word quality to Patti Smith's writing at times. Moving back to the book today, though, this is more of a traditional memoir for her, but it's still Patti Smith, so there's still variations in writing form that will just sort of jump in and kind of have like a poetic or like a spoken, almost like a staccato to them, like a movement, especially in the last chapter. But this book really takes place sort of before Just Kids and after. And it's, it does a lot with her childhood. And I looked outside of this book, just reading the book at interviews and that sort of thing, and she really wanted to give a shout-out to her parents and the foundation that they gave her. And I will say, I don't want to give everything away, but there's a little twist in that, too. But it's a story of her childhood, growing up in a large family, very poor, very sickly. She actually had TB when she was a child. And then her growth as an artist and as a writer really came out of seeing things like old-fashioned magazines and seeing fashion for the first time, being like, what is that? Going to an art museum for the first time and having this just life-changing moment. And then books. Her mother provided her with books, the library. She was always who she is. And what this book, what I love about Patti Smith is that really strong voice of being an artist, of being an individual, of following who she is. It comes through in her writing, comes through in her art, her music. It's so incredibly powerful to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's sort of an icon. She's 78 years old now. And another great thing about this book, I would say, is it's really positive. She's been through a lot. She's lost the people she loved the most. Her husband, Fred Sonic Smith of the MC5, Robert Mapplethorpe, her muse in her life. He was her muse. She was his. Her brother, who she was extremely close with. And so this thread of just losing these people and sort of moving on and how she does is really powerful. There's a lot of Michigan in this one. A big piece of the book is, you know, she's doing the music that we all know, and then she's sort of getting restless. Like, what's my life about? And she gets married to Fred Sonic Smith, really falls head over heels in love with him, moves to St. Clair Shores, lives in this house. They have a boat, and she has this writing studio, which becomes a baby room. So there's just so many, like, domestic details. It was really, really good. And you close the book and you just feel like, oh, I love this. This woman who's still in tune with something that makes her who she is. It sounds like this isn't making sense what I'm saying, but if you read the book, I think you'll understand. Or if you do love her and know anything about her, you can just see it. You can feel it. Mm-hmm. Just Kids, I must say, is in my top 5 books of all time. And I would recommend it to anybody if you haven't already. It's just transporting. And to hear her read it, to hear her, I'm forever moved by that book. There's nothing like it, really, to me. I mean, probably, top 5, because I've many books like that, but it's just that wonderful. So, mm-hmm.
Very cool. I'm going to close my portion with 2 novellas, very, very different. The first one is let's call it a fairy tale retelling, is probably the best thing. I want to talk about Cinder House by Freya Marsk. Freya is the author of really pretty popular queer romantic fantasy trilogy called The Last Binding Trilogy. And this is like two books beyond that now. And just the end of the year here, she released Cinder House. It's a reimagining of Cinderella. In it, she introduces Ella, who's murdered pretty much on the first page, along with her father. And there, as it's happening, their magical home basically responds by, it sort of throws up it just reacts big and magically and kind of holds her to the house. So she's now haunting her family home. and she's invisible. She kind of disappears for a while, but over time she's becomes able to kind of hold a form, and but the only people who can see her are her stepmother and her stepsisters, and they unfortunately figure out pretty quickly that she has a compulsion to kind of keep the house orderly. She kind of did before, but it's worse now. So, and add to that, they can threaten the house. It will hurt her. So basically, if they hurt the house, so she basically has to take their orders. And she is now a ghost who has to cook, clean, keep house, repair things. And she's sort of stuck. Cinderella. There is a ball, there are shoes, there's even a handsome prince, but the story does not go where you would expect it to go. It's a really fresh take. It's for fans of T. Kingfisher. It's for fans of Alex Hauer's kind of fractured fairy tale retellings. It's an interesting the happily ever after is not quite what one would expect. And it's a very interesting take on Cinderella, I thought.
All right.
And again, this is a novella. It's one of the Tor novella series, and I continually love to give... If you are new to Freya Marsk, this actually is a good place to start. Her other books are wonderful, but if you want just a taste, this is a nice novella. The other one I want to point out is we pretty much started the year, actually in our February episode, I talked about Daniel Lavery's Women's Hotel, which is the quirky, it's a quirky look, character study of the residents of the Biedermeier Hotel, and it's sort of 1960s New York women's hotels right at the end of that kind of trend in housing in New York City. And Daniel put out a wonderful little holiday novella that kind of goes back in and looks at where they are going, the various characters we kind of loved in the first book. And it's just a lovely, funny holiday novella that peeks back at the ladies and occasional gentlemen in and around the Biedermeier Hotel during the 1965 holiday season. And it's just, it's quirky, it's funny. It's an interesting look at women in that time, in that place. And it's a nice holiday addition to the story.
Very nice. That sounds really good. So does Women's
Hotel. And
again,
they're also really well, both of them were good audiobooks, but I really like the Women's Hotel's audiobooks.
Okay, very cool. Well, I'm going to do my last book here. It was a book from 2024 that I really wanted to get to. I should just stop saying that on the podcast because basically that's the story of almost every book. I wanted to get to it. I couldn't get to it.
We always wanted to get there.
Yeah.
We get there in the right time eventually.
Yeah, it sort of happens. So this was a big award winner last year. It's called Whiskey Tender, a memoir by Deborah Jackson Taffa. And Deborah is a member of the Ketchin Nation, which is the Yuma, and the Laguna Pueblo tribe. She's a member of both nations, which is sort of key to the story. I had to read a little bit more. I wanted to read more about the memoir itself. And interestingly, Deborah Jackson Taffa wanted to write this for many reasons. But one of them is there aren't that many Gen X Indigenous memoirs. There are younger generation authors, and many of the older gen, not many, never enough, but many seminal works by older generations, and she really wanted to represent this. She also wanted to tell a story that was of her family, which includes a lot of trauma, but not to be like something of trauma to gawk at. It had to be, it had to tell a story of why and some of the causes and some of the reasons why intergenerational trauma was so present in her family. And she says, this is my family story, but it could be almost anybody, Indigenous person's story, really. Mm-hmm. What has been done to Indigenous people in this country is covered in many different ways.
Absolutely.
Incarceration of men. Mm-hmm. Almost every topic you can think of filters into here. Educational trauma, really, about how Indigenous history is taught or not taught at all, misrepresentation. There was a time when her name is Deborah Jackson Taffo, when she was proud to have Andrew Jackson's last name, you know, before she knew, before she understood how horrible that is. So this is this. There's so much here. It's hard to sort of summarize it really quickly, but it's really a story of parents who left their reservation and really wanted to give their children the American dream, and in that sort of tamp down their Indigenous heritage, really push it down. And so when it's a really warm family story in many ways. There's a lot of love. There's a lot of humor. A lot of really great family stories, but. Then they leave the reservation and they go live in New Mexico. They go from California to New Mexico, and they're in Navajo territory. And they're not accepted as Indigenous there. They're othered there too. And the story just sort of goes through this sort of coming of age and to where Deborah Jackson Taffo hits a point where she learns about Indigenous history really for the first time. And it catapults her into a very deep depression. And it's sort of this... recreation or reconciling, and your family's still like, why are you focusing on this so much? It's hurting you. It's bringing you down. This is what we didn't want for you, essentially. And she's like, but I need to go through this. I need to understand this. And then there's an emergence. So it's definitely a story of reclamation. It is a story of great trauma and sadness, a lot of family history. She literally went into archives to get more family history of her family. But it's an unearthing, and then it's sort of, in a way, there's some joy at the end of this. I'm a complete person now. I'm not just, I don't need to deny all of this. It is part of me, and now how do I move forward? And she's the head of the MFA program at the Institute for American Indian Studies in Santa Fe. That's where Joy Harjo studied. And she's a beautiful writer, I must add. It is one of the most well-crafted memoirs I've read as far as so well edited, so well presented. It's just very clear, smooth, just rolls. You can listen to it. I did listen and read, and both were just very smooth.
I would agree. And that I listened to the audiobook mostly. Okay. I think I finished it reading it. And again, it's a really well done story.
Yeah, kind of lulls with a more family story, kind of lighter, and then it gets heavier.
Yeah.
I'd say.
Yeah,
definitely.
I'd agree.
And I think that's intentional.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
very good story. Very well written. Memoir.
All right. So I have the last two books. My first one is also another graphic novel. It's kind of a memoir, How to Say Goodbye in Cuban by Daniel Meares. And in some ways, it's kind of an ode to his father. This is a book about his father, Daniel Meares' father, grew up in Cuba in the 1950s, and it's kind of a story leading up to the revolution in 1962, and just the process. So it's very much slice of life because, you know, you see the family on a farm and then moving to the city, and slowly the family, Daniel's father, who is Carlos, his family is prospering. Things being taken away from them, businesses being controlled and shut down. But it's just a beautiful kind of slice of life where they're, you know, going back and forth, like what they would do as children going to the beach. There's a curious little section about, you know, winning the lottery that the grandfather, you know, happens to come across some. And just really interesting introduction, I guess you could say, if you're especially kids and of course adults too, because I read it, others would quickly be able to get that little insight into what that process was like for people and why Cubans came to America during that time period, and the lasting effects that the history of, you know, that revolution with Fidel Castro had on the country. The other book I want to mention is a picture book. Oh, this is one of my favorites, Wind Watchers by Mika Archer. This is a picture book kind of like taking on, you know, wind as a person, as a, you know, someone you address. We love it when wind answers with one big whoosh and you're at the beach and you feel the air coming. I love this book because children are so aware of, in this case, the wind. But this author is really, last time around, she wrote Wonder Walkers, which is also a little bit about hiking. But this, I just love the story. It's kind of poetic in some ways, but just the descriptions or the illustrations and the in the book just really tell the story of what you're expecting to be happening with wind taking charge. I'm going to be gentle today. I'm going to be whooshing today. Really a neat, neat book. And I think it would be a really great read aloud for families and, you know, during the day or evening, whenever you do your story time. You can talk so much about, you know, just the illustrations. You've got an autumn scene in there. But also, I want to recommend it to our librarians. If you're out there listening for story times, this is a really great book. Really, really nice.
Okay, that autumn scene is beautiful.
Yeah,
it's got
it is.
A kid jumping into a pile of leaves.
Yeah, when you see the leaves kind of rustling around, this is just gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
Just gorgeous with
horses
and everybody.
You won, Cheryl.
Yeah. A horse in a blankie.
Very nice. So that's all I've got today.
That's so beautiful.
Just, yeah, I really liked it.
You could do so much with like spinning afterward, like you're blowing in the wind.
Yep.
Scarves, because I'm picking up the little current.
Can you hear me?
Does anybody still do the parachutes?
Yes, we did the parachutes at the Mason Library. It was so fun. The kids loved it. We didn't do it very often because they would get so excited. It was like a little much sometimes.
Well, you have
sometimes.
To have space for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we used to do
we barely did.
I remember parachutes when I was a kid.
Yeah. Oh, with a parachute when you were a child.
Elementary.
It was so exciting. And it was, again, very seldom, probably because it made the kids go squarely.
We had to be in the gym to do that one,
Yeah, certain some of them can be really big, so you're really in a lot of space for a parachute.
And you play popcorn. So fun.
Okay.
Oh, yes, the wind. The wind is a thing in Michigan, that's for sure.
It has been very much. So, okay, I think this is our last pod for the year.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
And we will get right
back in January, and we have a guest in January, so that will be really fun.
So everybody have, you know, wonderful holiday season, and we'll get back to it.
All right.